This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details. Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of Screen Talk. Show number 12, folks, and another great one for you. I'm going to kickstart the show straight away with music. I'm not going to do a long intro, but this is from the movie True Romance. Now, I think I was about 18, 16, 17 or something when I saw this. This was the first film I ever saw at the Prince Charles Cinema in about 92 or 93 or something. And what I love about this piece of music is it's beautiful and uplifting and warm and kind of almost sentimental, even though it's the score to an uber-violent bloodfest of a movie. This is Hans Zimmer's You're So Cool from True Romance. Piece of music. Another interesting thing about that song is it's exactly the same, almost note for note, as the music from Badlands, which I think is Carl Orff's Gorsenhauer. But there's no mention of it in True Romance or the Hans Zimmer. He doesn't say based on, but it's exactly the same piece of music. I don't want to create a legal battle here. I'm sure other people have noticed it. But it's a weird thing, and I'm sure it must be intentional, because Badlands is a film about a young couple in love who are killing people, and so is True Romance. So they must be like, oh yeah, why don't we pay homage to that? Right, now, today we have an amazing show. Another brilliant guest, the writer, director, and star, or co-lead, I don't know how you say it, but from the recent Channel 4 comedy Flowers, Mr. Will Sharp. But first, as is becoming a regular thing, I am joined by Shortlist magazine film editor Mr. James Gill-I-Am. Do you like my new nickname for you, James?
I'll take that, thanks very much.
Because you do remind me of Will-I-Am.
We're very similar. I mean, the number of people who stop me in the streets and say, "Were you in the Black Eyed Peas?" Yeah. Or "What's Fergie really like?"
Yeah, yeah.
But now I can confirm that.
Maybe they think you're Prince Andrew.
Maybe they do.
Yeah.
Maybe they do.
Do you get the Fergie reference?
I do.
Yeah,
I do.
You just didn't find it funny.
Do you remember? Well, the thing with Fergie, I'm of an age where if you say her name, and I don't mean Sir Alex, I mean that. Sarah.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you remember Togate? That was like massive news at the time.
I don't remember Togate.
Front page of all the papers.
What is Togate?
She was, I don't want to get executed for saying this, but she was papped sucking on a boyfriend's toes while sunbathing.
Wow.
It was massive at the time. I'm talking like, I think I was in Centre Parks on holiday when it happened.
Yeah.
I'm saying that. Where were you when Togate broke? As if it's JFK. Do you not remember Togate?
No, I do not remember it. Man. I thought it was a place in like Shropshire or something.
Beautiful this time of year is Togate.
Right, so what news do you bring with you this week, James?
Well, Justin Lin, the director of the Fast Furious movies, I think he did four of them. He did three, four, five, six. My maths is correct. Yeah. He did four of them. Vin Diesel has personally asked him to return to direct the 10th and probably the final installment of the Fast. And I mean, they're pretty fast and pretty furious by now.
Yeah.
And Justin Lin, I think, is going to pick Space Jam 2 over Fast and Furious 10.
Now, I'm sure that's surprising, right? That is a weird choice. A sequel to a film from like 15 years ago that's not really considered a classic or anything.
I think there's a lot of love for Space Jam
because
the Looney Tunes characters are just wonderful. It's got Michael Jordan in it, and Bill Murray is being very Bill Murray in it. But I know what you mean. It's not iconic. It's not as, I mean, that.
When you've got the pick of the crop, do you go to Space Jam 2? Is I guess what I'm asking.
Well, now I'm about to. I'm going to come across horrendously with what I'm about to say here. But I was lucky enough to speak with Justin Lin last week.
It's your job, so don't be ashamed of it.
Honestly, I feel so guilty. It came up at an Always Be Comedy recently. During a break, I had to interview a film director. Because it was LA time and Always Be Comedy happens at 8 p.m. and I had to apologise to the audience.
Because you had to go off and interview a film director.
Yeah, because I'm aware that it sounds so, oh, did you really? You know what I mean? But Justin Lin, his reasoning for taking Space Jam 2, should he definitely do that, is the fact that he has a six-year-old son who has never been able to see a single thing that his dad has made.
Mm.
So it's almost like he doesn't believe that his dad is a director, because his dad leaves first thing in the morning, spends all day on a film set. But there is no proof for the poor lad, because he's six. He can't watch Star Trek Beyond this summer. He can't watch any Fast Furious movie. So a big reason for him taking Space Jam 2 would be the fact that he could say to his son, look, your dad is actually a director.
Is the Fast and Furious movies, are they actually unsuitable for six-year-olds?
Yes, there's quite a bit of...
Is there swearing?
There's quite a bit of swearing and also...
Sexy time?
A little bit of sexy time, but the violence is... hilarious.
Really?
Yeah.
See, I don't think I've watched a single one, which is ridiculous, seeing as, you know, I host a film show, but they've just never appealed to me, and yet there must be something appealing about them, because they make so much money!
They're joyous in that they are ludicrous. You know, it's cars flying through buildings.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that the humans in these films are practically invincible.
Because they parachute in cars and things like that, right?
But more than that, apparently there is... I don't want to get sued, but there is a strong rumour that each of the megastars in the films has it written into their contracts that they are not allowed to lose a fight. So the fight scenes...
I thought you were going to say a car.
So the fight... lose a lot of cars. Yeah, yeah. The fight scenes go on forever, but say Vin Diesel is not allowed to lose a fight scene because it is in his contract. And The Rock allegedly has the same clause. So they'll have these heroic fights that go on for ages, but it will invariably end up a draw. Yeah, or okay, if some poor sap who might just have joined the franchise as, say, a baddie, they will probably lose the fight because...
Well, we know that anyway about films with heroes, right?
Well, some baddies don't lose. So Statham, for example, has become such a staple of the movies that you can't lose Jason.
No. Well, why would we be watching a film about a guy that loses all his fights? That would be weird, wouldn't it?
Well,
I could be the star of that film.
Well,
an ordinary guy that gets into a few scrapes, but...
There is nobility in losing a fight, though, which is why Rocky has endured.
Yeah.
But the Fast Furious movies is a bit like... It is essentially like watching a superhero movie, really. They don't have a cape, but they are really...
Invincible,
They are superheroes.
And to me, it just feels like a sort of big-budget version of Top Gear, but with Vin Diesel instead of Jeremy Clarkson. Because, actually, the stunts they do on Top Gear are just as ludicrous, really, aren't they?
You pretty much nailed it.
Yeah.
Top Gear, add Vin Diesel equals Fast and Furious.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's not spend too much time talking about the Fast and Furious. What else have we got?
Well, I suppose going on to the superhero theme, Captain America is passing a billion... I was about to say he's passing water. He's quite an old guy, to be fair. Captain America
He's about 100
he
now,
must be
is
an
he?
Old dude.
Yeah.
So I would watch that in a sequel. Watch Captain America passing water. He's about to pass $1 billion worldwide, which when you think about it is incredible. So you might listen to that and think, $1 billion, pretty standard these days. But that's the third movie in the Captain America series and the umpteenth in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It's the fact that that is... And also Captain
Usually America, sequels are sort of diminishing returns, right?
Yeah, pretty much. And also, in this country, Captain America, because of his name, is never going to be one of our favourite superheroes. Yeah. He's not Spider-Man. He's not Superman. He's not Batman. So for Captain America to take a billion...
He's not even got man at the end of his name.
He's not even got man. He should be Captain America, man.
Captain American man.
So for that to take $1 billion, I think, is just incredible. And the Marvel Cinematic Universe has now passed $10 billion.
Well, so you and I talk a lot about our difference in opinion on the superhero phenomenon, shall we call it. I'm just a bit like, do we need this many superhero movies? But the point that you make quite clearly this morning was... If you've got, what's it you said? If you've got superhero fatigue, you probably just leave the planet.
If you have superhero fatigue, you need to leave the planet because the figures I am reading out there suggest that this will just run. I mean, for example, Batman versus Superman has taken something like 800 or 900 million worldwide, and that's considered a flop.
Oh,
I mean, not a flop, but you know what I mean. It's considered falling short of expectations.
Yeah.
So I mean, they're here to stay. What I would say is because this big thing of superhero fatigue keeps coming up, I think the positive to take, I mean, I always see the positive, but the positive to take out of that is that it does put pressure on these filmmakers to make sure these films are as good as possible. So Deadpool was a wonderful film, a real pleasant surprise for a lot of people. And Captain America Civil War is one of the strongest films that Marvel have ever made. So the great thing is, because so many get made, there is that survival of the fittest thing that comes in. These movies have to be exceptional.
Question is, what is different about each of these films other than the action set pieces? Or is that all that matters?
No,
because to me it just seems like, especially when you do the origin story of nearly every different superhero, it's sort of same story, different cape. That's how it feels to me.
So, I mean, Marvel have had that criticism levelled at them, and they've actually lampooned the fact that so many of their films are too similar. There's the Michael Douglas gag in Ant-Man, for example, where they reference the fact that they are aware that that is a criticism. I would say those movies are so much more than action set pieces, though. It's the people who work on the films, and also it's the talent they manage to get. So Ant-Man is a good example. He says, referencing his own example, but it's a good example because they attracted Paul Rudd. Now, any film fan would lie down in traffic for Paul Rudd because we all wish we were Paul Rudd. The guy is awesome. So the fact that they make those slightly left field choices Guardians of the Galaxy is another good example. Yeah. Chris Pratt was not a megastar before that movie. They cast that film so beautifully. In a nutshell, they know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. It's not just
a case of Marvel in particular. It's not just a case of let's pick a megastar. It's a case of casting it very carefully. Robert Downey Jr. as Iron Man.
Yeah.
I mean, that guy was better known for getting into trouble. The guy is now...
He was actually uninsurable.
He was uninsurable. Yeah. I mean, Robert Downey Jr., there was a time where the story, his story was one of squandered talent, mm-hmm. whereas now I think of him as one of the most charismatic actors I've ever seen.
And he's almost like establishment now.
He was
anti everything for a period. I always loved him. Always, there was a period in the sort of late 90s where he's just not going to sort his shit out.
But
he still did like supporting roles in films, and he always just completely stole the show. I mean, I love the film Wonder Boys. Have you seen Wonder Boys?
I have seen
Michael
Wonder
Douglas.
Boys.
Really underrated, cool little film directed by Curtis Hanson. And Downey Jr. is just, every scene he's in, it's just like, who is this man? He is amazing. And then finally, they managed to make it work that he could be the star he always meant to be. Do you know what I mean?
It is amazing.
After years and years. Like, I think he was in like some of those like Weird Science and stuff in the mid-80s. So he has been around a long time.
He was part of the... What were they called?
The
Brat Pack.
Yeah.
The Brat Pack, that's right. You had the Rat Pack, the Brat Pack, and then the Frat Pack.
Yeah.
And he was the Brat Pack.
Can't wait.
But the dude's a survivor.
He is. I actually sometimes think people with... addictions and problems often become brilliant stars because all that energy and all that time that they're trying to focus not thinking about their previous addiction, they really put into their career and into their work. So there's quite a lot of examples, which sometimes isn't a great... I think like kids think, all right, so I could go off and do heroin for a few years and then afterwards sort my
become
shit out
a megastar.
And earn millions of dollars.
I agree with you 100%. I totally
Although
agree.
It's also, obviously, being serious, a good example of sorting your shit out. But there are mixed messages there.
But you're right. There is definitely something in that. It's focusing all that energy and then they just throw themselves. Their career becomes their addiction, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. What else we got?
So Disney are now planning a live-action remake of The Little Mermaid. Now, some of you might just think, well, I won't go see that, which is fine, but what it probably means is that Disney will be plundering their entire back catalogue and remaking the lot of them as live-action remakes.
We're going to do our five favourite Disney movies sometime, I think, because it's not a brand that I often think about in terms of my favourite movies, but actually, just even thinking about it for 5 minutes earlier, I was like, oh wow, there's a lot that actually means so much to me from my youth. So we'll do that. We'll touch upon that. But I agree, yeah. They're even doing a Mary Poppins sequel, aren't they?
That's right,
they
are.
With Emily Blunt.
Yes.
I think she's agreed, or I don't know if
that's a good choice. Yeah. Everyone loves Emily Blunt.
Yeah, yeah. What about this sketch that is doing the rounds from SNL?
Do you find that, we might not have time for this, do you find that there are certain actresses who women love, and then for whatever reason there are certain actresses who women really loathe with a passion?
Yeah.
But Emily Blunt is one of the few who everyone would agree, everyone loves Emily Blunt.
Yeah, why? I'm not entirely sure why that is. Maybe her... off-screen and not antics, but like her interviews and the things that she does aren't getting her any kind of reputation or anything. She seems like quite a straightforward...
She seems to have her shizzle together, doesn't she?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying
to say. She's never disappeared up her own backside. She seems nice. She seems funny. She's got
Has
more
anyone
than
ever
just...
been able to do that?
One or two have tried it.
So this SNL sketch, you sent me the link the second you saw it.
Yes. I knew you'd enjoy it.
I fucking loved it. Why don't you explain, without giving away the sort of the real big joke of it, what the sketch is?
So what I will say is I'm a huge Saturday Night Live fan, and so I can speak with authority when I say that Saturday Night Live, historically, I think to the outsider, some people just assume that it's always amazing.
Yeah.
It's not. It is a hit and miss show.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there is a biography on the show where the writers of the biography openly admit that it is up and down.
Well, of course. How do you have
exactly.
a hit rate when you're doing a show, an hour show every week? And live, it's just not pot. If you could do that, then
you'd have lightning in a bottle.
Yeah.
So some miss, some hit. However, They produced a sketch in season 41's finale that I think is one of the finest. I've watched it so many times already. You know, because sometimes we're guilty of short-term thinking, so you might see a sketch and go, that's the best thing I've ever seen, and then you sleep on it. Ah, no, it's not. But I've watched that a few times this week, and it's glorious. So it's a loving spoof pastiche of Dead Poets Society with also a nod to films such as Goodbye, Mr. Chips, which is probably where they've got the title from. Mm-hmm. Farewell, Mr. Bunting. So Fred Armisen, an ex-SNL member, who played Barack Obama when he was a cast member.
Was he hosting the show or something that week?
He was back as host that week. Yeah. Okay. And so he plays the Robin Williams-type figure of the teacher who has lost his job because he was too much of a maverick. So he has
James
to...
James did a little wobble.
I did a little wobble there. I really methoded. Yeah. He becomes a bit of a maverick. Daniel Day-Lewis would have gone, that was good wobbling. So he has to come back and interrupt a class to collect his belongings, and it's a nod to the captain.
It's almost shot for shot the end scene of... Anyway, check it out. It's on the SNL YouTube channel. It's really fucking funny. But it got me thinking a lot about Peter Weir, the director of Dead Poets Society. And Dead Poets, right, was a film for me, a really pivotal film. I think I was 13 when I saw that, and it was the first film I snuck into a 15 certificate movie for in the Beckenham ABC. Beckenham ABC.
Nice.
And it was the first film that probably wasn't an action film or a comedy or, you know, like a grown-up drama in a way that I think I ever saw of my own accord, and it completely changed the way I looked at films. Now, I sometimes feel like it's been given over the years, it's sort of tarnished with like it's a bit cheesy or a bit naff, but I think it's, you know, it's a really beautiful film. And then I was thinking more about Peter Weir, and again, like we spoke last week about Rob Reiner and all the great films he's directed, even though he's never really shouted out as one of the all-time greats, Peter Weir got an amazing CV of movies, right?
An incredible career.
Yeah.
And also responsible for bringing some of the finest performances of proper, you know, Hollywood icons of their career. I still think to this day that Witness, controversially, because I know everyone would say Star Wars or Raiders of the Lost Ark, I think Witness is Harrison Ford's best performance, and it's his best movie. I love the film Witness so hard. Yeah. There's a scene in Witness, I apologise if I'm jumping too far ahead here.
No.
There's a scene in Witness, dear listener, that I would put into my top five all-time greatest scenes ever.
Is it the corn? No.
It's the scene where Lucas Haas is looking into the cabinet in the police station, and he recognises the faces.
Oh, that one, right, yeah.
And Harrison Ford, I believe, is on the phone, and Harrison Ford spots Lucas Haas. He sees what he's looking at, and in slow motion, Harrison Ford knows what Lucas Haas has seen. He knows what's going on. And as he stands up, if I had hair, it would be standing on end. I think it's just the most perfect scene because that connection between the two of them.
Well, my favourite scene from that film is when he beats up one of the people that are picking on. Because it's so gut-wrenching because you go, okay, he's being a hero, but he's also being a tremendous dick because he's doing everything that's against what the Amish people believe in. And he properly beats up this.
The great thing about that scene is that every now and then I love in a film a scene where you'd be sat on the sofa and you actually say out loud, "Get in there!" And when Harrison Ford does beat
this
up...
This is where you and I are different. I'm thinking about the moral complexities well, yeah, you know, you're beating him up because he's picking on them, but, you know, like, you're doing everything they disbelieve. You're like, just fucking hit him!
Stick up for him, Harrison! And then the old guy says something like, no English, it is not our way. Yeah. Harrison Ford said, but it's mine.
Does he say mine? He doesn't say the American way or something.
No, he doesn't.
That would have been even worse. Oh, my God. That wouldn't happen in a Peter Weir film. But Peter, it's Weir, the American way. It's the Trump way.
Chuck Norris would have said that. Yeah. But it's the American way. That is a wonderful scene. It's where the guys waved the ice cream into the guy from Die Hard's nose, isn't it?
Is Viggo Mortensen's one of the Amish?
Yes, young Viggo.
He followed that up with...
Don't know much about his story.
He followed the Witness up, Peter Weir did, with The Mosquito Coast, which was also Harrison Ford. And that's a weird little film. Like, I love it. I think it's great, but it's so... And River Phoenix plays his son. And have you seen it? It's
no.
Like they go... He basically forces his family to go and live off of the land, and they go and live in some sort of tropical... But he's so kind of determined and stubborn that he, even though it's going horribly wrong, he just won't give up. He won't let... And his family are all like, Dad, can we just go back and live in a normal house? And you've got to watch it. It's a really interesting film. Yeah. What other classic? He's done The Truman Show, obviously.
Gallipoli is a great movie.
Yeah, and The Year of Living Dangerously, both Gibson movies.
The Truman Show, I would go so far as to say that will be remembered as an all-time classic. And when you rewatch it now, it still holds up. As the world he creates in that, the one in which Truman lives, is so believable and authentic that that is what really stays with you.
And also, strangely still very, very sort of relevant... Even though you would have thought, oh, yeah, we're a bit over all that sort
so
of.
So relevant now, yeah. Isn't it?
Master and Commander.
An absolute
amazing film.
Fantastic.
Again, I think weirdly a bit... I feel like I'm saying underrated all the time, but...
No, it probably is a bit underrated.
Yeah.
And also, because Patrick O'Brien wrote so many novels based on those characters.
Right.
The movie was... The film was so good, and there was so much left to explore. I know that Russell Crowe says that when he's in England, that's the film he gets bothered about the most.
Really?
Yeah, and it tends to be an older English guy who will bump into him and say something like... So, when are we doing another Patrick O'Brien film? And for whatever reason, it's just not happened. But there's I would love for Crowe and Peter Weir to revisit those movies.
That would be amazing.
Yeah.
Green Card, Fearless.
Green Card was a big hit.
It was a big hit.
A big commercial hit.
Fearless, I think, a flawed film, but an amazing performance from Jeff Bridges. And I haven't seen The Way Back yet, which I hear is good.
The Way...
No?
It's pretty stodgy.
You went down a tap there.
I'd say this of The Way Back. If it's ever shown at the cinema, go see it at the cinema. Because if you watch it at home, I promise you will look
Not
at your phone.
Right,
or,
okay.
You know, okay. Oh, that washing up better get done.
I mean, he is like in his 80s now or something.
I think he's early 70s. There's a film he has in development called The Keep, which sounds like a horror, which I hope gets made, just because it'll be another Peter Weir movie.
Well, here's to Peter Weir. We love you here at Screen Talk.
We love you here, Peter Weir.
Very good.
Last week I tweeted Carl Reiner.
Oh, I saw that.
Because Rob Reiner is not on Twitter, so I tweeted Carl to say Dan and I made a case that your son is one of the greats.
Nothing.
Literally nothing.
What a fucker!
Come on, Carl.
Carl, mate. If you listen to Rob Reiner interviews, there's a podcast somewhere. It might be the Marc Maron one where he talks about how his dad, Carl Reiner, and Mel Brooks. Mel Brooks, am I thinking? Mel Brooks?
Yes.
Yeah. They both lost their wives, sadly.
That's right.
And
yes.
They're just, they hang out all
they
the
do.
Time.
They do.
Just a couple of old mates, you know, knocking about.
Two icons of American comedy.
Yeah. Can you imagine? I wonder what they talk about.
Mel Brooks
the
is an awesome
The state of comedy,
dude.
Probably.
Because Mel Brooks produced The Elephant Man.
Did he?
Yes. Oh, I'll tell you what, the looks that I've just got from the guys
what,
in the studio.
Lynch?
Yeah, Mel Brooks produced that.
I always thought it was funnier than people gave it credit
for. I saw an interview with Mel Brooks and someone said, would you like to have directed that? And Mel Brooks said that he would have loved to have directed that. But the phrase he used was that by then he'd already painted himself into a corner. Which is, well, because he'd made so many crazy comedies.
I know, poor guy. What a tough situation to be in.
I
painted myself into a million-dollar corner.
He said it with a smile on his face. I think there's such... Mel Brooks is such a warm and funny guy. He's one dude. I'd love to meet Mel Brooks.
I know a writer, right? This, and I can't say his name because he'd kill me if I said this. A writer who lives and works in LA. He said he was working on a job.
Is it Drew Pearce?
No, it's not. he's not the only person I know out there. He was working on a studio lot, like Warner's or Paramount, somewhere. And with the job, he got an office. And in the office above him was Mel Brooks.
Stop it.
And then
Stop
one day
it.
He walked past and he sort of poked his head in and said, hey, guys, what are you up to? And they got chatting.
You're joking.
The next day, he did the same. by a week later, they saw him coming in and they were like, oh God, Mel's coming around again. They were like, can we say, look, we just need to do some work, Mel. You know, we've heard quite a lot of your stories.
No, yeah. That is the definition of ungrateful.
I know,
what?
I know. But I love the idea that it doesn't matter, because obviously I adore Mel Brooks and I think he's amazing, he's a genius. But I love the idea that even your heroes could outstay their welcome. Like, you know, look, I really do love your work, but I've got this script to finish. You know, I'm on a bit of a deadline. So our next guest coming up is the very talented writer, director, actor, Will Sharp. This is his first choice of song. It's a piece of score from the film Solaris, the original, by Edward Artemiev. I'm not sure if I'm saying that correctly. I'm sure he can correct me. This is the Solaris theme. Did I say that right, Will?
I don't know. I think
Artemiev?
So. I think it's actually by Bach.
Oh, is it?
But I think he was the composer that worked with Tarkovsky did the rest of the score. Or maybe he played it. Maybe he did an arrangement for it. I don't actually know that.
Are you a fan of the film?
Yeah, I haven't watched it for a while. But
where do you stand on the remake?
I haven't seen it, but apparently it's actually quite good.
Yeah. I've not seen the original, but I've seen the remake.
Okay.
And a review I read, I think in Time Out, said, as remakes go, it's pretty good. And if you haven't got time for the original one because it's quite long, then this is the good. This is the good sort of snippet version.
Yeah.
But I'm a big Soderbergh fan, so even his bad films, I'm a big fan of, just because I like that he does still mix it up with weird stuff. So, Will Sharp, everybody, welcome to the show, Will Sharp. I don't know what's order to say your sort of titles. Is it? Do you consider yourself actor first, writer, director?
I don't know.
You don't know? What do you say when people go, oh, so what do you do? Which is always a horrible question.
I don't know, just kind of curl up.
And go, I make stuff.
Yeah, it's embarrassing.
Why is that such a horrible question when people go, what do you do?
Because
I've never liked it.
I mean, I guess I don't necessarily see those things as different disciplines anyway. So, I think often feels like they're kind of part of the same thing, you know, making something, as you say.
And you you recently just had your own show. It was like 3 weeks ago? Flowers?
I think so, yes.
Yeah. And this was a show that you managed to, which is quite an achievement, to write, direct, and be a regular character in. How did you pull that off? How did you convince Channel 4 that you were the man to... I don't know.
I mean, it was a great... very lucky, obviously, to have had that opportunity. It was just a slow...
Did you just do it process, bit by bit?
Yeah, bit by bit, I think, step by step. So I did a really long treatment for it, which I sort of did for my... It sort of came about because some of the stuff I was pitching, people would say that they kind of liked the writing, but it felt like I was trying to sort of second guess what they were after, what they might commission, what might get made. Yeah. And they were sort of saying, you don't need to do that.
Who was that? The production
companies. Yeah. And so they were like, just write what you want to write. Mm-hmm. And that's how Flowers came about. And so I spent quite a lot of time just putting this quite extensive treatment together, pulling images together, because it's not really very pitchable show in a way.
Well, that was going to be one of my questions, is how do you pitch? Or first of all, for people that may not have seen it, which I recommend you do, and it's on the E4, what's it called? All4.com or whatever the thing is called.
Basically, the
iPlayer for Channel 4. And I'm sure it's also on Amazon and all those things as well, right? But how would you describe the show? Another horrible question.
Yeah. It centres around... probably fair to say dysfunctional family.
Mm-hmm. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah. And they all of the characters in their different ways have some kind of sort of carry a kind of loneliness or sort of some kind of problem, personal problem that they're trying to work through. Julian Barrett plays Morris, the father, who's a children's book author, and that kind of fairy tale vibe bleeds out into the world of the show a little bit. It's a slightly murky world, slightly cartoonish, maybe slightly heightened.
People, when the reviews were coming out, they were saying dark quite a lot, which I didn't think it was. I think that's a slightly misleading description, because often we associate dark with, like, maybe they're doing, I don't know, like rape jokes or...
Right,
you know,
yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's not... maybe it's just because it was quite dark in the way it was shot.
It was literally dark,
yeah.
Well, I completely agree. I think Naomi DePere, the producer, and I, we came to describe it as a sort of sad comedy rather than a dark comedy, just because we were really careful to try and make sure it wasn't willfully dark ever, and it wasn't trying to shock anyone or surprise anyone. There are difficult issues that are dealt with within the show, and it was always really important to all of, including the channel, you know, that we were never making fun of. For example, Morris, the character that Julian plays, is you quite quickly discover suffering from some kind of depression, and we...
Well, isn't the very opening shot? I know this is a spoiler, but
it's not really, is it?
He tries unsuccessfully to kill himself. If it had been successful, that would have been... I don't know how you would have got Julian to do it. Hey, will you play this part? He's in it for 3 seconds. He tries to kill himself but fails. So you kind of know. I guess, again, that's probably where the dark thing comes from.
I think so, and I understand why. But I think it might be a slightly, perhaps, arguably lazy shorthand, because it does deal with dramatic and occasionally difficult subject matter, but I don't think it's a kind of black comedy or dark comedy in the way that it's traditionally used.
No, because there's also a bit of silliness, and you said yourself, a little bit of cartoonishness.
Yeah.
I guess some of the darkness or sadness is that they are, even though they're a family, that all, even though the two twin children are in their mid-20s, is that right?
Yeah.
Even though they all live together, which is actually quite weird in this day and age, especially if you live in like a city or something, but they're all almost as though they're walking around in completely their own worlds.
Yeah.
You know, so that loneliness.
Which
I think people would probably connect to. If they weren't like, oh God, this is... If they didn't watch the first 5 minutes and think, oh, this is dark comedy, if they stayed with it and went, actually, I relate to these themes, you know.
Well, that was, that was one of the nice things about how people seemed to be watching it, was that depending on who you were, you connected to a different part of the show, different character, different scene you know, in a given episode seem to resonate with different people more. So, you know, talking about it afterwards, some people thought that it was all about one scene, mm-hmm. and other people thought it was actually the episode was centered around a different scene, okay. just because of, I guess, who they were relating to the most.
And, yeah, yeah.
So that was nice, I guess. Yeah. Like,
is it all, because I'm halfway through at the moment, is it all linear, or not linear, but like the timeline? Because it literally picks up where it left off on the previous episode. Does it do that pretty much all the way through the
series?
There's
a couple of gaps. We did sort of like solidify that at some point where it was kind of, I think, episode two happens straight after episode mm-hmm. one. Episode three is like maybe a few days later. Mm-hmm. And then, oh, I can't remember. Mm-hmm. But like it happens over a relatively short space of time, like at most a few weeks.
And was that a reason for why they decided to put it out every night of 1 week rather than the traditional?
It might have been. I think it might have been part of it. That came about because the Channel 4 quite liked it, and so they had a meeting.
That's nice of them.
That was nice, yeah. Yeah. It was sort of a surprise, I guess. Like, or they had some kind of meeting that I don't really understand. Like, how I imagine it's probably not. Yeah, like, imagine sort of graphs and, yeah. like, spreadsheets and stuff. But basically, they just had a scheduling meeting about it and yeah. decided that it would be the best way to release it, I think, partly just as a way of saying that it's a bit different, mm-hmm. so they release it a bit differently.
Yeah, yeah.
And also because it is a sort of continuing narrative across mm-hmm. the series, it just, I think, encourages you to, if you started, to carry on watching till the end, which was something that we wanted people to see. Yeah. You know?
And I guess in this day and age where Netflix and Amazon put series out in yeah. their entirety,
yeah.
people are more used to it. I did wonder when I heard that it was doing that, because I was aware of the show. I know Julian, and you also used Layla Hoffman, who was mm-hmm. in my show, which I was pleased to say she's yeah. amazing. Yeah. I knew people, I knew of you, so I was, and I'd heard good things, so I was excited, and I heard that they were putting it out in 1 week, and I couldn't work out, without speaking to you or any of Channel 4, in my head, I was like, is that good? In one way, that's good, but there's something about going, you're on telly for longer if it goes out
right,
once a week,
yeah.
if you know what I mean, and you got that momentum, but I don't know, I guess there's pros and cons for both.
Probably. I mean, initially, I was like, oh, it sounds like a weird idea. But then within an hour of talking about it with the producer, we both sort of realised that it did seem to make a lot of sense. And I sort of, each shows that I like, you know, I might seek out the first episode, watch it when it comes out, if mm-hmm. I'm free, make a point of that. And then if I like it as much as I think I will, I'll try my best to watch the second one. But with the best will in the world, I just sort of, thinking back to shows that I've enjoyed, I haven't really watched them when they've gone out to the end. Mm-hmm. It's been a month or two later, I've suddenly gone, oh, I need to finish watching that, and then I'll watch the rest of it on a Sunday when I happen to be free. So, I don't know, it kind of is, I thought it was a forward-thinking move as opposed to a sort of backward-thinking move, if that
definitely,
makes sense.
Yeah. Is I mean, if anything, you must have just been, because this is your first series, right? So you must have just been absolutely chuffed that it's going out, because you made a movie before this, Black Pond, and that was self-financed, was it?
Or? That was where we co-directed that with my friend Tom Kingsley, mm-hmm. And we've just finished our second feature, which we mm-hmm. made in a similar way, which is called The Darkest Universe, and we'll be on at the East End Film Festival.
Okay, when's that? Just do
that
a
is
plug.
We're on the 1st of July at Genesis.
Cool. So when you do a film that's, like, as we talk about this a lot here, where people think that the hard thing is getting a film made, but the hard thing is getting it seen by people and distribution.
Yeah.
So to a TV show, knowing you're making something that would definitely have a life must be quite a liberating feeling.
Yeah, and terrifying as well, yeah.
Well, you want it to be in the corner where no one sees it.
There's a kind of safety to that, I suppose. So it was really, that was just on a day-to-day level, one pro of it going out mm-hmm. in a week was that it was just a really quick And then it was over. Yeah. And then just kind of so
you have a slightly different attitude to having a TV show. Some people are like, I want more, I want more. I want a bit more limelight.
I'm happiest making it, I think.
I do remember, and that's the way it should be, I think, you know, enjoy the process. But I do remember hearing a story. This was when Chris Morris used to do a lot of TV, and especially with Brass Eye, when it was getting more and more edgier, that he would just go away when it goes out. Just sort of, I don't know if this is true, but I think with that kind of thing, probably there's a reason behind it. He just doesn't want to hear any of the furor. But
I can understand that.
I think we get a bit too focused on the end product and how it goes sometimes. But so when you did Black Pond, this was something. This was when did you make Black Pond?
This is probably wrong, but I think we first screened it in 2011, kind of end of 2011. So.
5 years.
Yeah.
This is your first movie. We all know movies are hard to make, hard to get off the ground. I always thought you love the film, by the way, and I love all the casting choices. But I thought strange casting choices because you had Chris Langham, who had recently gone through a lot of controversy, and Simon Amstel, who I know and love, who at the time was definitely known as a presenter. Mm-hmm. And I was like, Do you just want to make life a bit harder for yourself by picking, like, you know, curveball casting?
Well, with Chris...
What was the idea behind that casting?
Well, with Chris, we picked him genuinely because we thought he would be the best person for the role.
And he is great, isn't
it? Yeah, I think his performance is amazing. And in terms of, like, all of the other sides to that question of why we cast Chris, I would probably, like, the best thing to do is just direct you to... Tom and I wrote a piece in The Independent on Sunday about why we did it, and it's because it is quite a sort of delicate issue in a way. It sort of lays it out in a clear and thorough, complete way,
but sort of avoiding going down, because I'm not sort of bringing it up to talk about all that complicated and very you know, complex stuff, but more about you picking someone that you know you're going to have to, like, either justify your choice or people might have preconceptions. This is your first film. Were you not tempted to go, like, okay, he might not be right, but let's get, you know, Benedict Cumberbatch or whoever is the hot thing at the time, or maybe someone not as big, but, or were you just like, we've just got to get the right person regardless of what baggage?
I think that was our attitude.
Yeah.
And also, like, in development, we would talk sometimes about the character as, like, what would Hugh Abbott from The Thick of It be like at home, like when he's at home.
So
Chris was kind of in my head even when writing the script.
Yeah.
And, you know, we weren't anyone. We were no one. So it was kind of like a big deal to ask Chris. We were like, well, should we just try and get in touch with him and see if he'll do it? And when he was up for meeting and talk about it, we were really excited. You know, it was... It was just a creative decision, basically.
And Simon, for very different reasons. I think a lot of people now know that Simon, there's more to him than, you know, when he was known for Nevermind the Buzzcocks. His stand-up is very challenging and dark and interesting. He's proved himself to be an actor. I love Simon a lot. But at the time, there's still that thing of, you know, are some people, you've got the two biggest names in your thing and...
Yeah.
What was the reasoning?
Well, I knew Simon kind of socially through comedy, and we'd been wanting to, like, work together in some capacity for a while, and he happened to be free. And I think I just found the idea of him as someone sinister quite exciting.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he's like a sort of lovable, clownish, sensitive, sentimental kind of lyrical stand-up, but I just sort of suddenly the idea of that being used to kind of manipulative ends or kind of sinister ends,
sort
I found
of
that
Norman Bates-ish
maybe
type
I
of
don't
thing.
Know I found that quite frightening, and he was up for it, and again we were just really happy that he was up for it, and it was fun.
It was great. So you've got another film with Tom.
Yeah.
And what is that about?
So that is called The Darkest Universe. It's about a girl in her 20s who goes on a canal boat trip with her boyfriend, and they go missing. And so the lead character is called Alice, played by Teenie Gosh, mm-hmm. who I co-wrote the script with, and her boyfriend is played by Joe Thomas from The Inbetweeners and Fresh Meat. And they go on this canal boat trip. They disappear. The film takes place in two timelines. I play Alice's older brother, and basically I'm trying to find them to like limited success. And it cuts between that journey, the search for them, and the relationship that the brother and sister had, which was kind of, for the most part, quite fraught.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's about grief, it's kind of comedy drama, psycho, little bit, some sci-fi themes in there, okay. but it's not a sci-fi film.
Would you say it's similar tonish-wise to all the stuff you've done to date?
Yeah, probably. It's slightly more, maybe it's slightly more dramatic, like towards drama, if there is like a sort of comedy drama spectrum. Like, but
we
still
can
funny,
one.
We think, we hope anyway. Yeah, yeah. We screened it first at the London Comedy Film Festival, which was really fun, and people did laugh. So there, it's definitely a comedy in some form, but it's also quite...
I mean, even when things are a comedy, it's still, you know, questionable or subjective or...
Totally
so
subjective.
That's always a question, isn't it? It's always like a... I mean, screenings for comedies, I don't know if you feel the same way, but I like something you've made.
Yeah.
It's terrifying because...
Oh, yeah.
Have you ever done live comedy?
When I first moved to London, I did it for a bit.
So you know that thing that if you're doing a live performance and the audience aren't going for it, then you in your head can go, right, maybe I won't do what I was planning... slightly change or alter to suit the mood or the room. But you can't do that in a screening. You can't quickly run off and re-edit the end before they get to the end. You know, you just have to sit there and, you know. Thankfully, most of the time, screenings are quite a generous experience. But
I often find that I realise halfway through a screening that my body language is absolutely... bizarre. Like, I've just been completely sort of hunched
contorted.
And skewed. So tense.
Oh, God.
And then it's normally about half an hour in that I'm like, just try and sit normally like a normal person.
So you put yourself in a lot of these in the films and the TV show, and I haven't finished watching the series, but I love your performance in Flowers. I hope you don't mind me saying this, but it's sort of reminiscent of Bert Kwok a little bit, who recently passed away, so there's a little tribute. But there's something really, it reminds me sort of 70s comedies a little bit. Is that a fair thing to say?
I grew up in Japan till I was eight, and then we moved to England. And including sort of recently, I like watching Japanese comedy and comedy films and stuff. And sometimes I share those films with my friends. Like I've watched a few with Tom, for instance, and I really like seeing how people react to it, because it is kind of, it's not a million miles away, but sometimes it can get a bit wacky.
I think wacky is a good way of describing it.
And I wanted some
of
that.
What kind of comedy do you do? Wacky.
So I knew I wanted some of that flavour to be in Flowers somehow. And in the end, Shun, which is the character you're talking about, sort of became the conduit of that. But what I will say is that he is kind of an exercise in questioning that archetype, I think. And I think if someone else was playing it, it probably wouldn't be quite the same, because I was writing it, I knew that, you know, quite soon, from quite early on, that it was for myself. I could be quite confident about how to play it and what I was saying, and to be in full control of it. Whereas even if it was like a friend who was, you know, also Japanese or half Japanese, I think it would still have felt slightly different, you know, asking someone else to do these things and to behave in a certain way. And basically, like, all you'll hopefully see if you get to the end of the series, that all of the characters, basically, they do question their own archetypes, and you start to find out more about them. And Shun is no exception, in that you start to see where he comes from and why he is how he is, and why he's sort of so fiercely loyal to Flowers, for instance.
I also feel like, because it is a show about people living together who are completely disconnected, that he is this strange kind of go-between that you sort of need to... He's like the glue in a weird sort of way without them kind of realising it.
I know what you mean. I definitely like...
Or the messenger, in a way. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean.
Going from one room to another and...
Yeah.
I think it's a great flavour that somehow... On paper, you'd probably go, what? So there's this character. But it completely works.
Yeah. I like opposites. Mm-hmm. And seeing how things that are very contrasting, when you throw them together, you know, what happens. And I think that maybe is slightly related to what you're saying about how you need a bit of this and a bit of that, you know, to...
Now, your guilty pleasure, we do this every week. We have a film, we ask people to pick a film that they love, that they think is either underrated or they just know is bad, but they love it anyway. I'm not sure where you stand on this one, whether you think it's underrated or bad, but I really was surprised by this choice of yours. Tell the listeners what you've picked.
Well, I chose The Land Before Time. Maybe it's not really a great choice for what this segment is supposed to be. It was on television a couple of years ago, and I sort of started watching. It was about 20 minutes in, and I found myself just watching it to the end, and I felt guilty about how much I enjoy it, basically because it's a children's film.
Yeah.
So that's the only reason why it's a guilty pleasure. Mm-hmm. I think it's a really good film and really beautifully made, and it seems to be pretty well loved, I think, on the whole, by people who've seen it. I almost chose Dumb and Dumber because I like that as well.
But I don't think that's a guilty pleasure.
No.
Okay. I would say what I was going to ask you about The Land Before Time, which if people can't remember, it's the it's not Disney, is it? But
I think
it's actually Spielberg.
Spielberg and George Lucas executed.
Yeah. And it's Don Bluth did the animation, who you'll know all his work from the 80s. He did An American Tale and Where Dogs Go to Heaven.
All Dogs Go to Heaven.
All Dogs Go to Heaven. So you recognise that style immediately. And I started watching it last night. There's no dialogue for the first 3 minutes other than a narration sort of talking about the end of the world for dinosaurs. And it has this very slow pace. But it's definitely not a family movie. It's a kids movie.
Yeah.
But quite slow and grown up. It's like this weird... It's like, I can't imagine kids now... loving this film. Okay. Maybe I'm being unfair, but
I remember loving it as a kid, and it did, like, some quite intense things happen in it. Mm-hmm. Like the main character is like a sort of child Brontosaurus called Littlefoot, and
a childosaurus.
Yeah, his mum literally dies.
Yeah,
you know, during,
in like the first 8 minutes. Yeah. Or something. It's quite horrific.
And she's sort of murdered by a Tyrannosaurus Rex and an earthquake combined, I think. And I don't know, like, looking at it, I was reading up just now before going in about
in
how it was
room.
Received and, like, when it was, just in case you asked me, in case you quizzed me on it.
Yeah.
And I was interested to see, like, some people have written about how it, you know, it deals with prejudice between the different kinds of dinosaur, of how they...
Well, at the beginning, they're like, the two baby dinosaurs are trying to play with each other, and then the father of the three horns says, three horns don't play with long necks.
Yeah.
And it was slightly preachy, if I'm to be honest. But there was something strangely warm and safe about, I think, the look of it that just took me right back to my childhood.
Assuming. It looks hand-drawn.
Yeah, I think so. And the weird thing is it was in a time where they didn't get famous people to do the voices for characters, which is actually a fairly modern thing to get massive stars.
That is like what part of the game of watching any animation now is going, oh, who's that?
Yeah.
Who's that voice?
Who's that? I sort of feel sorry for what must have been a huge circuit, or maybe a small circuit, of voice actors who specialised in doing animation, and then suddenly they're just getting calls going, now they're going with Bruce Willis. Like, what, in a kids cartoon, and now it's just taken as read, you know. I'm not sure whether it's a guilty play. I mean, it's
maybe it's not. I mean, I felt guilty. People made fun of me because I immediately, like, started saying, oh, The Land Before Time was on, and it's amazing.
I suppose it's like, just because you're an adult that's the guilty element of it, that you're enjoying a children's film.
But it's maybe not, maybe it's cheating. I don't know. Yeah. Sorry.
Maybe it's not quite Transformers 3 or something.
Oh,
it's not
right,
quite as guilty as that. But
Yeah.
Put it this way, it's a surprising choice. Okay. Knowing your work, I was like, oh, okay. Kitty Dinosaur movie, yeah. And to finish off, your second choice of song, this is called Mountain Song, and I have to say, I watched the clip of this on YouTube, and this takes us slightly back to what you were saying about enjoying Japanese humour. Is there a link there?
I mean, this is...
I'm not sure where this is from, to be honest. I don't...
It's from a Japanese film called The Taste of Tea, which... came out quite a while ago, and I bought it on a visit to Japan in their equivalent of HMV, and literally just based on liking the cover of the DVD.
Great.
And then it became, I think for me, quite a sort of formative film to have watched, because it was very funny and also quite emotive, but also more than anything it combined quite heightened stylized fantastical elements with extremely naturalistic dialogue and kind of vignettes, and I just sort of thought that's great that they're doing both things. And this is a really weird sequence in it, which I encourage you to watch the film, and also
The Taste of Tea, check it out,
and also YouTube this clip of the Mountain Song, which
this really just put a spring in my step today, I tell you. Especially towards the end, it just gets so fun.
Yeah.
Well, thanks very much for being our guest. Good luck with the new film.
Thank you.
And people tune in to Flowers. It's still, like I said, available to stream. Thank you very much, Will.
Thanks for having me.
Ya, 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 ma, ya, ma, ya, ma. Ya, 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 ma, ya, ma, ya, ma. Ya 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 ma ya ma ya ma ya 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 ma ya ma ya ma ya 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 ma ya ma ya ma ya 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 ma ya ma ya ma
ya ma
ya ma
ya ma ya ma yo
ya ma yo ya ma yo ya ma yo ya ma yo 山は生きている山よ山よ山よ山よ山は生きている山よ山よ山よ山よ山は生きている生きている